He woke up inside a strange craft, where he was told, among other things, that the saucer people were keeping watch on the Earth to avoid a catastrophe. July 18, 1967, Boardman, Ohio. Reverend Anthony DiPolo was awakened by a strong sound similar to the background music of a science fiction television show. He thought that someone was telling him to go downstairs. He did so and looked outside. There, between his house and the next one, he saw a figure wearing a luminous suit. DiPolo went outside. The sound started again. Then he received the message, "You have nothing to fear. I shall not hurt you, and I know you will not harm me." DiPolo came closer. The sound started again, and he received a third message, "Danger. I must leave." DiPolo saw a light, or rather a kind of glow, in the sky. When he lowered his eyes, the strange entity had vanished. March 23, 1966, Temple, Oklahoma. W. E. Laxson, 57, a civilian instructor with the U.S. Air Force, was driving south toward Shepherd Air Force Base at 5 a.m. when he found the road blocked by a large object, the size of a Douglas C-124 Globemaster without wings or engines, resting on pads. A man dressed in coveralls, with a kind of baseball cap on his head, appeared to be examining something on the underside of the craft. When asked how this man looked, Laxson replied, "He was just a plain old GI mechanic. Or a crew chief or whatever he might happen to be on that crew. He had a flashlight in his hand and he was almost kneeling on his right knee with his left hand touching the bottom of the fuselage, which was about 3 feet from the pavement." And he added, "People wonder if they looked as an outer space deal. I told them I didn't know what an outer space deal looked like, but I do know this was made in America, I am sure. It had a plain old GI in it, I know that much. I would know the man if I saw him in Chicago tomorrow." On October 18, 1954, at 10:45 p.m., near the Lake of Saint Point, in the east of France, a Miss Bourriot saw a bright light on the road and stopped her bicycle. She saw a man, average in size, close to the light. With him were two dwarfs. The functioning lie, what does it all mean? Is it reasonable to draw a parallel between religious apparitions, the fairy faith, the reports of dwarf nursery.ings of immortality-like beings with supernatural powers, the airship tales in the United States in the last century, and the present stories of UFO landings? I would strongly argue that it is, for one simple reason: the mechanisms that have generated these various beliefs are identical. Their human context and their effect on humans are constant. And it is my conclusion that the observation of this very deep mechanism is a crucial one. It has little to do with the problem of knowing whether UFOs are physical objects or not. Attempting to understand the meaning, the purpose of the so-called flying saucers, as many people are doing today, is just as futile as was the pursuit of the fairies, if one makes the mistake of confusing appearance and reality. The phenomenon has stable, invariant features, some of which we have tried to identify and label clearly. But we have also had to note carefully the chameleon-like character of the secondary attributes of the sightings, the shapes of the objects, the appearances of their occupants, their reported statements, vary as a function of the cultural environment into which they are projected. The airship stories are especially relevant in this connection. As we have seen, a good number of bearded characters alighted in the Midwest and elsewhere in 1897, to request water from a well, bluestinks, or other similar things. The stories they told were believable, if somewhat astounding, to American farmers of the time. The airship itself corresponded to the popular concept of an elaborate flying machine. It had wheels, turbines, wings, powerful lights. There is only one detail not yet dealt with: the fact that the airship, though it was believable to the witnesses of 1897, is no longer credible to us. We know very well that the devices described could not possibly fly, unless its outside appearance was designed to deceive potential witnesses. But if so, why? And what was it? What was its purpose? Perhaps the airship, like the fairy tricks, the flying saucers, was a lie, so well engineered that its image in human consciousness could sink very deep indeed and then be forgotten, as UFO landings are forgotten, as the appearance of supernatural beings in the Middle Ages are forgotten. But, then, are they really forgotten? Human actions are based on imagination, belief, and faith, not on objective observation, as military and political experts know well. Even science, which claims its methods and theories are rationally developed, is really shaped by emotion and fancy, or by fear. And to control human imagination is to shape mankind's collective destiny, provided the source of this control is not identifiable by the public. And indeed it is one of the objectives of any government's policies to prepare the public for unavoidable changes or to stimulate its activity in some desirable direction. Thus the Soviets have skillfully employed the services of science fiction writers to supply the emotional support of their space effort among the young people. In the Western world, control over our imaginations is more diffuse, and many sources compete for it. But it is significant that intelligence agencies and advertising companies alike should be so highly interested in folklore. Not only are Batman and the Jolly Green Giant instances of experiments in this direction, the Vietnam War has seen similar appeals to public imagination through the use of local superstition. Recent discussions in Congress regarding the advisability of military experimentation with witchcraft in Black Africa is also a case in point. I am not saying, of course, that the UFO phenomenon is produced by a similar trick. But I do say that, beyond the question of the physical nature of the objects, we should be studying the deeper problem of their impact on our imagination and culture. Whatever they are, a lot of books about them have been written, sold, and read. How the UFO phenomena will affect, in the long run, our views about science, about religion, about the exploration of space, it is impossible to measure. But to those who follow the situation closely, the UFO phenomenon docs appear to have a real effect. And a peculiar feature of this mechanism is that it affects equally those who believe and those who oppose the reality of the phenomenon in a physical sense. For the time being, the only positive statement we can make, without fear of contradiction, is that, it is possible to make large a century ago, the French were using magicians to impress African leaders. Sections of any population believe in the existence of supernatural races, in the possibility of flying machines, in the plurality of inhabited worlds. By exposing them to a few carefully engineered scenes, the details of which are adapted to the culture and superstitions of a particular time and place. Could the meetings with UFO entities be such artificial constructions? Consider their change in character. In the United States, they appear as science fiction monsters. In South America, they are sanguinary and quick to get into a fight. In France, they behave like rational, Cartesian, peace-loving tourists. The Irish gentry, if we believe its spokesman, was an aristocratic race organized somewhat like a religious military order. The airship pilots were strongly individualistic characters with all the features of the American farmer. Now consider the following case, which I regard as the perfect landing. The date is October 23, 1954, and the place near Tripoli, Libya. About 3 a.m. an Italian farmer saw a flying craft land a few dozen yards from him. It was shaped like an egg laid horizontally. The upper half was transparent and flooded with very white light, the lower half appeared to be metallic. The forepart had two side ports, the central part an external ladder. The hind part had two vertically disposed wheels, one above the other, and two cylindrical protruding tubes. While descending, the craft made a noise similar to that of a compressor like those used for inflating car tires. No propeller was visible. The fuselage was surmounted by two antennae, one behind the other, and bore a kind of undercarriage with six wheels, two pairs in the forepart of the craft, one pair behind. The machine was about 6 yards long and 3 yards wide. Inside it were six men in yellowish coveralls wearing gas masks. One of them took his mask off in order to blow into a sort of tube. His face appeared to be that of a normal human being, When the witness got close to the object and put a hand on the ladder in order to climb it, a strong electric shock threw him to the ground. One of the occupants made gestures as if to warn him, for his sake, to keep away from the craft. Another occupant pulled out a wheel and again put it back where it formerly was. Then, pushing a button, he caused a kind of half-container to cover the wheel. Inside the cockpit, a kind of radio set, complete with wires and operated by a man with earphones, was visible. All six pilots were busy on their instrument panels. The incident lasted about 20 minutes. Then the object silently took off and reached an altitude of 50 yards. Then it went away at a dizzying speed, toward the east. The imprints left by the undercarriage's wheels on the soft ground have been photographed. They resembled those of normal rubber wheels. Their length was only about 2 feet. If it were possible to make three-dimensional holograms with mass, and to project them through time, I would say this is what the farmer saw. And with that theory we could explain many of the apparitions, in numerous UFO cases and in some religious miracles, the beings appeared as three-dimensional images whose feet did not actually touch the ground. But what about the other physical actions, such as the electric shocks? As we read the account of the Libyan landing case, it is tempting to assume that the farmer, far from witnessing by chance the maneuvers of interplanetary visitors, was deliberately exposed to a scene designed to be recorded by him and transmitted to us. Hence, the gas masks, the instrument panels, and the radio set, complete with wires. The same is true with the following Italian case, which took place in Abbiate Guazzone, near Vase, on April 24, 1950, at 10 p.m. Bruno Faccini heard and saw sparks which he attributed to a storm, but he soon discovered a dark mass hovering between a pole and a tree 200 yards from his house. A man dressed in tight-fitting clothes and wearing a helmet appeared to be making repairs. There were three other figures working around that huge craft. This work being over, a trap through which light had been shining was closed, and the thing took off. Other details were as follows. The object made a sound similar to that of a giant beehive and the air seemed strangely warm around it. Two of the men were standing on the ground near a ladder. The third one was on a telescopic elevator, the base of which touched the ground, and was holding something near a group of pipes. This produced the sparks seen by Faccini. They were about 5 feet 9 inches tall, dressed in grey diving suits with an oval transparent glass in front of their faces, which were concealed behind grey masks. From the fore portion of the masks a flexible pipe emerged at the level of the mouth. They wore earphones. Inside the craft could be seen a series of oxygen-type containers and many dials. When Faccini offered his help, the men talked among themselves in guttural sounds, and one of them took a camera-like device from around his neck and projected a beam of light on Faccini, who tumbled away for several yards. He was then caught by a rush of air and thrown again to the ground. They subsequently ignored him as they recovered the elevator and brought it inside the craft, which took off. After a sleepless night, Faccini returned to the site and found some metal fragments left by the soldering operation, also 4 circular imprints and patches of scorched grass. He revealed the observation only 10 days later, when his doctor treated him for the pains and bruises resulting from his fall and advised him to call police. Ministry of Defense technicians who examined the metal samples found them to consist of an anti-friction material very resistant to heat. The incident had other witnesses, who testified privately. One had Mr. Faccini been exposed deliberately to effect a pari 4, less than shun of space beings? What could be the purpose of such a worldwide elaborate hoax? Who can afford to contrive such a complex scheme, for so little apparent result? Is human imagination alone capable of 2, F playing such tricks on itself? Or should we hypothesize that an advance trace somewhere in the universe and sometime in the future has been showing us three-dimensional space operas for the last 2,000 years, in an attempt to guide our civilization? If so, they certainly do not deserve our congratulations. Are we dealing instead with a parallel universe, where there are races living, and where we may go at our expense, never return to the present. Are these races only semi-human, so that in order to maintain contact with us, they need crossbreeding with men and women of our planet? Is this the origin of the many tales and legends where genetics plays a great role, the symbolism of the virgin in occultism and religion, the fairy tales involving human midwives and changelings, the sexual overtones of the flying saucer reports, the biblical stories of intermarriage between the Lord's angels and terrestrial women, whose offspring were giants? From that mysterious universe, have objects that can materialize and dematerialize at will been projected? Are the UFOs windows rather than objects? There is nothing to support these assumptions, and yet, in view of the historical continuity of the phenomenon, alternatives are hard to find, unless we deny the reality of all the facts, as our peace of mind would indeed prefer. The problem cannot be solved today. If we absolutely must have something to believe, then we should join one of the numerous groups of people who have all the answers. Read Menzel's books or the Condon Report, that fine piece of scientific recklessness. Or subscribe to the magazines that prove that flying saucers are real and from outer space. I have not written this book for such people, but for those few who have gone through all this and have graduated to a higher, clearer level of perception of the total meaning of that tenuous dream that underlies the many nightmares of human history, for those who have recognized, within themselves and in others, the delicate levers of imagination and will not be afraid to experiment with them. Conjectures. It may seem useless to conjecture about a phenomenon that, according to all authorities, remains unidentified. But this book has shown that it has left a clear series of marks in the beliefs and attitudes of our contemporaries, in a pattern not only identifiable but also by no means unprecedented. Hence it is not necessarily pointless to try to devise critical tests, both sociological and physical in nature, to determine whether or not purposeful design is involved in the phenomena the witnesses describe. If the answer is yes, the problem of deducing the identity of the intelligence that generates it is not necessarily a solvable one. This latter fact should therefore be the basis of any future attempt at theoretical interpretation. Whenever a set of unusual circumstances is presented, it is in the nature of the human mind to analyze it until a rational pattern is encountered at some level. But it is quite conceivable that matter should present us with circumstances so deeply organized that our observational and logical errors would entirely mask the pattern to be identified. To the scientist, there is nothing new here. The history of science consists in dual progress, the refinement of observational techniques and the improvement of analytical methods. On the other hand, the proposition that the universe might contain intelligent creatures exhibiting such an organization that no model of it could be constructed on the basis of currently classified concepts is also theoretically plausible. The behavior of such beings would then necessarily appear and more absurd, or would go undetected, especially if they possessed physical means of retiring at will beyond the human perceptual range. It is interesting, but only incidental, to observe that such physical actions would appear on scientific records as mere random accidents, easily ascribable to instrumental error or to a variety of natural causes. Considering the UFO phenomenon as a special instance of that more fundamental question, we are presented with the dual possibility of very long-term unsolvability and of continued manifestation. And this is true whether the phenomenon is natural or artificial in nature. This being the case, the development of a new myth feeding upon this duality is entirely predictable. In the absence of a rational solution to the mystery, and public interest in the matter being intense, it is quite likely that in the coming years every new brand of charlatanism will use it as a base, although it is not possible to predict its exact form. We may very well be living the early years of a new mythological movement, and it may eventually give our technological age its Olympus, its fairyland, or its Walhalla, whether we regard such a development as an asset or as a blow to our culture. Because many observations of UFO phenomena appear self-consistent and at the same time irreconcilable with scientific knowledge, a logical vacuum has been created that human imagination tries to fill with its own fantasies. Such situations have been frequently observed in the past, and they have given us both the highest and the basest forms of religious, poetic, and political activity. It is entirely possible that the phenomenon we study here will give rise to similar developments, because its manifestations coincide with a renewal of interest in the human value of technology. There currently is considerable puzzlement among the public, and especially among the young, whenever the attitude of scientists confronted with such phenomena is discussed. Sometimes their questions contain a note of anguish. Typically, they ask the following: how can we react to the flood of absurd, incoherent stories about flying saucers? What is the use of pursuing a study of science if it cannot be applied to the rational analysis of such phenomena? In a time when the young are encouraged to follow with enthusiasm the progress of space exploration, why should the subject of life in the universe be a forbidden topic? Several organizations exist in the United States devoted to the investigation of this problem. They seem to have the support of some reputable scientists, and they often allege that the government is convinced that the phenomena have an intelligent origin, but that it hides the truth from the public. Should we not join such organizations to gain knowledge of the subject? A tentative answer could perhaps be formulated as follows. First, it is a mistake to believe in authority, or to put blind faith in official reports, scientific theses, or the theory of a particular author, whenever a point of research is discussed. As objective as my reader perhaps thinks I am, I cannot help but have a general image in mind as I write this book, and so do all writers, even writers on subjects as amenable to objective analysis as chemistry or geometry, no matter how loudly they deny being biased. Therefore, one must borrow from books only those elements that appear properly documented, and they must be confronted with a larger human context. A good researcher should not be afraid to change his mind. He should not feel desperate because his comforting beliefs leave him as soon as he begins to think critically. If he applies these rules, he may not solve all the problems he attacks, but at least he will be less likely to fall victim of every delusion or fad that is associated with them. Just as some cheap magazines are deliberately written to generate fear in the public and to capitalize on that fear, some scientific reports are deliberate hoaxes designed to reinforce the credibility of our scientific, political, or military establishments. This is a fact of life, and it should not discourage one from the study of science. It does not necessarily mean that anybody is hiding some formidable truth. If the idea that science knows nothing about certain phenomena is unacceptable to the public, why should it be more easily acceptable to professional scientists? Those groups of enthusiasts who advocate a crash study of flying saucers by specially hired scientific consultants forget that a given discipline can make progress only if competent professionals are genuinely and sufficiently interested in it to direct their efforts toward its solution, and this is not done by money alone, or by act of Congress. Either there is no scientific value at all in the many UFO observations that have accumulated over the years, in which case no amount of publicity will have any effect on its solution, or these observations contain scientific pay dirt, in which case that residue will be recognized and exploited by direct research, and will result in novel developments that current methods are by definition incapable of predicting. A young researcher should keep in mind that he will never make a serious contribution to the study of this problem, or of any problem, unless he first develops his own competence to the point where he can select an aspect of it and cover it by himself, without relying on the emotional form of thinking which characterizes the enthusiast. It is precisely because science is the process through which unsolvable emotional arguments can be transformed into organized sets of sub-problems amenable to rational analysis that the UFO phenomenon is interesting. Therefore, to say that UFOs are not a scientific problem, or even to pose the question, is to utter an absurdity. There is no such thing as a scientific problem. It is the man who looks at the problem who is scientific in his approach or who is not. Science is an object in the mind of man, not a characteristic we are at liberty either to bestow upon or to withdraw from every funny-looking contraption that happens to cross our skies. For a scientist, The only valid question, in this context, is to decide whether the phenomenon can be studied by itself, or whether it is an instance of a deeper problem. This book has attempted to illustrate, and only to illustrate, the latter approach. And the conclusion is that, through the UFO phenomenon, we have the unique opportunity to observe folklore in the making, and to gather scientific material at the deepest source of human imagination. We will be the object of much contempt by future students of our civilization if we allow this material to be lost, for tradition is a meteor which, once it falls, cannot be rekindled. The manner in which observations are gathered should lie of interest to the sociologist because it exhibits certain amusing features. There is a tendency among the believers to gather into large, very formal organizations, where they waste all their energy and, sometimes, a good deal of money, with practically no visible result. It is clear that such organizations answer a psychological need rather than a genuine desire to discover the answer to an interesting intellectual problem. Maintaining such a group implies a tremendous overhead, mailing lists, bookkeeping, etc., and experience shows that research is always the last activity it can afford. Instead, these groups generate so much internal bitterness and so many intra-organizational feuds that they prove to be serious obstacles to independent researchers who are simply trying to get first-hand data and do not care to support one particular personality or theory against another. There are so many such groups now that their publications no longer reach the scientists, who can hardly be expected to read 15 or 20 specialized magazines every month. If people really wanted to get at the root of the UFO phenomenon, they should simply constitute a large number of small, informal circles, the only objective of which would be the gathering of first-hand reports. It should be obvious that professional scientists are not in a position to do this. They know the problem only through the daily press, which does not give information on reports made outside a small area. When it does, the witness account is so biased that the information becomes worthless, and even if the article is accurate, there is no way to measure the reliability of the witnesses or to learn their standing in the community. Only local residents can evaluate such an odd occurrence as a UFO sighting at its true weight. The creation of a network of active but informal groups would also help solve the problem of documentation and publication. When the main organized groups do conduct investigations, they bury them in their files or publish only biased, heavily edited summaries, thus screwing down the lid on the observational material they precisely set out to reveal. To summarize, neither a crash program staffed with 20 Nobel Prize winners, nor computer correlations of millions of poorly observed parameters, nor mental telepathy with superior space beings, nor the organization of hundreds of people into observation squads, scanning the heavens every night with binoculars and a pure heart, will easily dispose of a problem that has eluded our radar, aircraft, astronomers, and physical theories for so long. The only thing that might help us make some progress toward an understanding of the phenomenon is the publication of good reports. They must be first-hand reports. They must be gathered fast and published fast. They must circulate freely. In the United States, unfortunately, there is not a single serious journal whose columns are open to private researchers for the publication of such investigations, but there are several respected periodicals in other parts of the world, notably the Flying Saucer Review, of London, often quoted here, which is becoming a major source of material for the student of folklore. In French, the Jaeger Bulletin and Lumiere's Dans la Nuit are two sources whose honesty this writer has found indisputable. But none of these publications has the answer to the UFO problem. The material for many years of very constructive study lies about us unnoticed. It is only when witnesses come forward with the type of observation discussed in this book that we realize that never in history has the human mind been so productive, so secret, and so fascinating. We must finally address ourselves to the question, if we reject the naive theory that the UFO phenomenon is caused by friendly visitors from Mars, what alternatives can we suggest? It is amusing to try to answer this question. Imaginative science fiction buffs could perhaps look into the following lines of speculation. 1. there exists a natural phenomenon whose manifestations border on both the physical and the mental.